This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I'm going to have a fun-filled day. I have a guest in the studio, and I have two guests lined up. But first, I'm turning to my guest in the studio, and I am so happy to welcome Carol J. Perry back, because it's a release date for her new book. Wow. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Patsy. Thank you so much for letting me stop by on my release day, which is always so exciting for every writer.
It is. And I'm holding it up to the camera, and the book is called It Takes a Coven, and it's another of your Witch City mysteries.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. This is number
six.
Number six. My goodness, Carol. When I met you, you were on number one. And
I know.
Well, isn't it
pretty fast, too.
Pretty fast, and so many exciting things, including the fact that Carol is available in Barnes & Noble on that, what do they call it?
It's an end cap. This one begins on March 6th and runs through April 8th. Every Barnes & Noble in this great land has an end cap display of Cozy Mysteries, all Kensington, 30 different books, and I'm so pleased that three of them are mine.
Three. Oh.
This one, the new one, It Takes a Coven, and the one before that, Grave Errors. And this time, they're featuring book one, which is very exciting to me, because sometimes people start to read in the middle of the series, and then they want to know how it began. Yeah. So book one, which was Caught Dead-Handed, and introduced the characters and my wonderful cat, Orion. So I'm thrilled that that's going to be there, too. So maybe people will start at the beginning and read all the way through. I'm working on book eight now.
Wow. And that's what I love. Well, it's partly because you have wonderful characters. Lee Barrett, of course, is the star in many ways.
Yes, yes.
But, of course, she has a cat who is always featured on the covers, and a delightful cat. You have never seen such a delightful cat as Orion. Very clever cat. And so I think it's beautiful. Of course, you have beautiful covers. And we're going to talk more about Lee Barrett and her paranormal, a touch of paranormal.
Yes. Lee Barrett has discovered in her 30s that she has a not entirely welcome gift. She's what's called a scryer. That is, she sees visions in shiny surfaces. And even some of my readers say, well, that would be great. Why does she distrust it? Well, she mostly sees death and dying things in the reflection, so she's not pleased with it.
That doesn't make you real thrilled.
And her
but it makes for a great story.
She has a police detective boyfriend, Pete Mondello, and Pete is a straight arrow cop, just the facts, ma'am. And he is really distressed by this sort of
okay, well, we're going to talk more about Carol's books and about this exciting book that's been released today. And because I have somebody else I have to talk to now with great joy, I am so happy to welcome to the program John Hart. Hi, John, are you there?
Hey, Patsy, yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, you know, the hush. I'm afraid of swamps, by the way. So when I got it, I said, I've always been, all my life, I've been terrified of swamps. But you put a sort of a new reason to be terrified of swamps. The new book is absolutely fantastic. Of course, it follows, you know, I have admired your work, I think, since it came out. Redemption Road was fantastic. Then, when the last child came out, I thought, well, he's getting better and better. And, of course, you're winning prizes all the time. You know, I mean, I would take up the whole program talking about all the prizes that you've won. But it's just wonderful. The new book is called The Hush, and it is set in a swamp. So tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, thanks for having me, Patsy, and thanks for those kind words. You know, whenever we start a new book and send it out into the world, it's always a question mark how they're going to be received. So, you know, to have someone like you who's so widely read respond to it in that way is meaningful. So thank you for that. Let me talk briefly about the title, The Hush. That is in reference to a term that's been around for a long time called Hush Arbor. And that's actually a bit of an historical artifact, Hush Arbor. Back in the days of slavery, those slaves who chose to pursue Christianity often did so in secret for reasons you can probably imagine. And they would do so in these secret places out in the swamps and in the woods that were referred to as hush arbors, or in some places, brush harbors. But the idea was that they could worship and have no church that could be discovered, no hymnals that might be left lying about. It was a safe and secret way to do it, and the hush in the title is in reference to a 6,000-acre, nearly forgotten tract of terrifying swampland where back in the 1800s, slaves did worship in secret and, in fact, settled there once they were given their freedom for very mysterious reasons by a man who is, in fact, the great ancestor of the main character in the hush, Johnny Merriman. So that's where the term the hush comes from. That's what a hush arbor is. And as you might imagine, given that it's the title, it's all very integral to the story.
And, of course, it's set in South Carolina, right?
North Carolina, actually.
North Carolina. It's set in North Carolina. And one of the things is that's where you're originally from, right?
That's right. Born and raised. I'm actually in North Carolina today. This is the beginning of the five-week tour. The book released today, so my first official event is this evening at the local Barnes & Noble.
Well, what is in the water in North Carolina? Because there are so many fantastic authors. Just in your area, you have Margaret Maron, the Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster, and you have Sharon McCrum.
Well, and then, you know, I'm from here, but I live in Charlottesville, so I've got John Grisham right down the road, Jan Caron is there, Rita Mae Brown,
wow.
Corbin Addison, a number of us are there, and it's a really, I love places where writers gather. It seems to, in fact, have something in the water.
It must, because, and of all of them, I think you are like, wow, when you write about this swamp, well, just in general, about this area, you make it come alive.
Well, there was some great historical inspiration for this story, and let me just give, for your listeners' benefit, a little bit of insight into what I mean. So in the story, in the novel, this group of descendants of freed slaves have been living for 170 years in this swamp, you know, left alone, isolated, and we discover throughout the book that the terrifying, strange things are happening in the swamp, very difficult to explain things. But the genesis of the idea, in some ways, came from North Carolina history. There's a massive swamp that sort of straddles the border between North Carolina and Virginia up near the coast called the Great Dismal Swamp, and it's, at one point, I think it was a 500,000 acres, but there is a long, long tradition of runaway slaves and escaped convicts making homes for themselves in the Great Dismal Swamp because it was so treacherous and almost uncrossable. No one wanted to go in there. It was so perilous. So for years and years and years, I mean decades, there were these outlaw communities living deep in the swamps. And I love that idea, just the imagery of that, and that's kind of what led me to this element of the hush, at least.
And in addition to the story of the swamp and what's happening in the swamp, it's also a very moving story about a friendship between the two characters who were in The Last Child, Johnny Merriman, and Jack Cross, who is now a lawyer. And it's a very compelling friendship that they have.
Well, I love stories of friendship, and I love stories of family. You know, we can all relate on some way or another, whether we've been, you know, disappointed or frustrated, or whether it's the most meaningful things in our lives. I think that thematic elements that delve into those parts of shared humanity just give a little bit of richness to the story. And you know, there's always this tension in any good story where the interests of the different characters should and do diverge, and then it becomes a question of what are they going to put first? Are they going to put their own interests first, their friends' interests first, the family? And I think that just gives a little extra depth and richness to an otherwise self-standing story. But it's that extra layer that I really like to explore.
And there's also the element here of protecting the environment, protecting this swamp. So it makes it very relevant. This is a story that's 10 years on from the first book, The Last Child, although this is a standalone, so no one has to have read The Last Child, although it helps because so many of the characters are in this book too. But it's a very important story from the point of view of protecting, and we have our bad guy here is actually the one who wants to develop this land and drain the swamp. And so tell us, where did that idea come from?
Well, I'm a huge land conservationist. That's one of my passions. I live on a farm in Virginia. I've protected it through conservation easements. And a lot of this stems from the fact that growing up here in North Carolina, we had a 500-acre farm on the river that was sold when my parents divorced, and it was literally turned into a junkyard and a trailer park, and it's just heartbreaking to see it. Plywood additions, dogs on short chains, rusting cars. It took a beautiful piece of property that had been untouched since a land grant from the king in the 1600s, and now it's ruined beyond repair. So it's an important thing for me, but more importantly, it really informs this character of Johnny Merriman. So Johnny, after the events in The Last Child, he suffers from this kind of dark celebrity. He's got all this notoriety. The people in town are fascinated in unhealthy ways, perhaps, with what he endured as a child. So he's retreated out into the 6,000 acres of swampy land that belonged once to his family and now belongs to him, and he guards it fearlessly. I mean, he will attack anyone that hunts it. He will stalk trespassers, and we learn later on that there's an almost unbelievable, certainly unexpected, reason for this compelling and powerful attachment that he has to the land. That there is, in fact, something elemental at play in Hush Harbor. And I just had so much fun combining those two elements of story, my love for conservation, and giving some of that to this character and his fierceness and his love of the place where he lives.
Well, they're describing it a little bit as if the book has some paranormal aspects. Would you say that's the right way to describe it?
Well, I struggle with this. So the common term might be supernatural thriller, and I find that term a little garish. I don't like that. Magical realism, I think, is a fair way to describe some of the elements. One of the journalists that interviewed me from England described the book as being elemental, which I really love. And what he means by that is that there is this tapestry that weaves connections to the land, the people, the past, and the future, or the present, rather, and there are these connections where things that happened in the 1850s, they were so powerful and so meaningful that they really attached to the land in a way that affect Johnny even now in the present day. And there are things unseen, and there are mysteries that we don't fully understand. And I've basically tried to combine the Southern Gothic mystery thriller that I've been writing for a while now with some of these elements. And personally, I think it worked really well, and I had a lot of fun doing it.
Oh, I think it works very well. And you're right. You know, when I first was told about with the idea that it was paranormal, I thought, oh, and I know your books, and I thought, I don't think so. But it's not. I mean, it's not that paranormal is wonderful. And as a matter of fact, I have a guest in the studio who writes paranormal, a book where her character, and she's sitting right here, and her name is Carol J. Perry. Carol, say hi to John.
Hi, John.
And she writes books that she's from Salem, Massachusetts, so she writes the Witch City Mysteries, which are very popular. They have an element of paranormal in them. But this is more, I like what that English interviewer used, the term elemental, because there is in your story, there is all of these strange things that sort of come together and touch on each other, and it is it is magical in many ways, and I found it very compelling as I was reading it, and I'm saying, whoa, he's done a great job here. Well, you always do a great job, because I never forget that eagle nest, that where when you wrote about that eagle nest, I still, every time I think of an eagle, I think of that scene in your, that you wrote once. And so in this book, I'm thinking, whoa, I just, you know, I really like the way that you've combined all of the different elements. And there we have it. Elemental, right?
Elemental. Well, let me say something about your comment on the eagle nest. You know, that was the opening scene of The Last Child, which is where we first saw Johnny Merriman. And keep in mind what was going on with Johnny at that time. This is a boy who's, the book is about his search for his missing sister and the fact that everything he's been taught since birth to believe in has failed him. You know, the church can't fix his life, his family can't, the community can't, the police can't. So this is about a boy trying to find power. And he's climbing that giant tree to that eagle's nest in search of eagle feathers because he believes, based on old Indian mythology, that there is a power in eagle feathers. You know, only chiefs were allowed to wear eagle feathers. And so here's this kid who's lost everything, and he's literally in search of some sort of magical force to help him gather the threads of his destroyed life and regain some kind of control. And what I love about the hush is that, you know, this is the conclusion of that quest. I mean, he looked for it in The Last Child, and The Last Child, as we know, is grounded very much in the real. He didn't really find it. But, you know, here we are 10 years later, and, you know, through circumstance and the mysteries of the universe, you know, here he is in this very exceptional place with very inexplicable things happening and affecting him in powerful ways. And so, to me, it's a closing of the circle.
Well, it is, and that's why I think as I was reading this, my mind went back, you know, quite a few times to that eagle nest. It is one of the best openings for a book ever. I mean, you read that, of course, once you read that, you have to read the whole book. But you're right, that right there, you set it up that he did believe in magic. He did believe in something, and he risked a lot to climb up to an eagle's nest. I can tell you, that's, you know, quite a feat. But that wanting that feather, and it does carry through both of the books.
Well, it does, and I think it's such an, here we are back at that elemental term, it's such an elemental quality to this character. I mean, it's his, you know, he's so self-reliant and so reserved and so quietly strong, but he has this deep, desperate need to believe in something bigger than himself, and everything he'd been told since birth he should believe in, you know, have let him down. So, you know, he's looking for other avenues, and damn if he doesn't find it.
Well, you know, I was thinking, of course, you're a lawyer, and I talked the other day to another lawyer. I just all of you lawyers who get tired of the law turn into great authors. And Kristen Hanna was on the program, and of course they've taken her book, The Nightingale, and they're going to make a film out of it. And I was thinking, as I'm reading The Hush, I'm thinking of it in terms of a film. I visualized it in my head. I was thinking of it, parts of it were a real scary film, but I would almost like to see them combine the two books into one film, one just gigantic, or maybe you know, one of those six-part series on television, because if you combine the two, it carries through beautifully.
Yeah. I agree. I think that'd be lovely. We are actually hoping to be filming The Last Child in May and June of this year. It's in casting right now.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, we'll see. There are always things that can go wrong, but they just cast the child actor to play Johnny, and they're talking to others to round out the cast. And, you know, we'll see. If they can pull it off, that'd be great, but you know, I don't like to put the cart before the horse, but I'm really hopeful that we'll be filming in a few months.
Oh, I hope so, because it's going, that book alone will make a great film, because just that opening scene, everybody's gonna love it. But I as I said, when I'm reading The Hush, I kept thinking, whoa, they're going to have to make a film out of this, because people will really, I think it will be a real big hit when it becomes a film.
Well, there's so much that can be done with it, and it's, you know, the visual lushness alone, I think, would be crazy exceptional. And you know how it is when you – it's dangerous to put too many elements in play in a book, because I mean, if you don't tie it together well at the end, it's going to leave readers frustrated. And, you know, I always like to take chances when I start a new book, and I knew I was taking a chance with this one in so many ways. And one of them was, you know, I put a lot of storylines in play, and I'm delighted that they're working out and that you're feeling as you are about the book. I really can't say thank you enough for that. That's just great to hear.
Well, it is. I mean, you did take a risk inserting some new elements. We're going to use that word a lot now because, you know, sometimes it happens that readers typecast an author and they want the same type of book over and over. And it's hard for an author to add that extra dimension. But I think you've done it so seamlessly that it works.
Well, you know, I do believe, and I say this all the time, that any writer that is not working in a state of perpetual discomfort is not taking enough chances. And, you know, safe writing makes for boring fiction. And so I've made a sort of a vow to myself that I'm never going to stop taking chances. And I knew going into this that I would lose some of those dyed-in-the-wool readers that just want another standalone thriller. But my hope is I'll find a broader audience because of these added dimensions.
I think you will. I think that I said, when one starts reading this book, one is almost literally drawn into the swamp, and in this way, an interesting swamp, not the swamp that everybody hears on the news, but a much better swamp,
yeah.
A much better swamp, and of course. Well, what can I say? You've done it again. Do you have I need to ask you. First of all, how do you write? Do you write on a computer or do you write longhand?
No, I can't read my own handwriting. It's atrocious.
So you're on the computer.
I work on a laptop, you know, and I don't outline. I get in debates with writer friends about that, and I've tried to write outlines, and usually by page 20, I've rendered the whole thing moot because I've come up with some better idea or some different character, and So I write in the school of grope and hope. You know, I flesh out these characters in my mind. I put them in motion, and I just kind of see where the story goes.
And it certainly goes with this story. You've done a beautiful job, and of course, you know, I think that there's something special about lawyers, because when you guys turn to writing, whether it's Kristen Hanna, Robert K. Tannenbaum, or Linda Fairstein, you guys are good writers. You are solid. So that I think that helps a lot.
Well, you know, I think that anybody that makes it through law school knows how to put their nose to the grindstone and get it done. And I think that that's one of the common threads lawyers have, and that plus a strong desire to do something other than being a lawyer. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just because there are so many lawyers out there. You know, they're just enough lawyers to make just enough good writers.
Okay.
But whatever the case is, I'm in agreement. I think it's an interesting little career path to track.
And pretty soon you're going to have like a whole room. Do you have like a whole wall already filled with all of the awards you're getting? I can't even go through all of them because it's really quite amazing. I mean, relatively short time. It's not you know, that you've been writing that long. You're still, you know, coming along there. So I can't imagine you just keep adding them up and adding them up. And of course, everybody, I know David Baldacci loves your writing. He was on the program recently. And I know he's one of your fans. And that's pretty good, huh?
Oh, no, it's great. Look, I love all the writers that are willing to take a chance reading someone else's work and then being willing to step up and help promote it. You know, and David's one of those guys that speaks from the heart. I mean, he doesn't I don't think he just says nice things to be nice. I think that he takes the time to read the book, and if he responds, then he says something nice. And I've always appreciated that about him.
Oh, I know. He always reads a book, and because it's something that – is important to him. He loves to encourage writers, and I know that that he loved this book, and I did too. And I think you've done a wonderful job, and I so want to thank you. And by the way, the Audible version is also fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. They gave the job to a guy named Jeremy Bob, and he's just fantastic. I'm listening to it as I'm on tour. I'm not through it all the way yet. I'm deeply in enough to know that I like the way he's doing it, but I'm only still about a third through. So I'll finish it up as I drive from town to town this week.
Okay. Well, have a wonderful tour, and I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you. And the name of the book is The Hush, and the author is John Hart, and everybody has to just go on wherever books are sold, and they will find it. And I think it's going to be another one of these instant bestsellers. So I'm very proud that you were on Joy on Paper today.
Well, Patsy, thank you so much. This has been truly delightful, and I hope you have a great day.
Okay, you too. Bye bye now. Okay, wow. I'm holding it up to the camera too, and people can see it. This is the Audible version. They send me the Audible. They send me the book. I get all of these things. I get boxes and boxes of books now. It's unbelievable. And unfortunately, I just have a new postman, and my old postman was wonderful because he delivered everything to my door. So I have to train the new one. So Carol. It's exciting for you because today is also his release date, your release date.
Why are release dates always Tuesday?
Ah, this is a good question. Why are release dates always Tuesday? And this is something that I'm going to be writing about, actually, in my book, because I'm going to be writing a book. But why is Tuesday? Well, first of all, because who wants to do anything on Mondays, right? I mean, no. But traditionally, all major books, and now you are a major book. See, Carol is a major, major book, are released on Tuesdays. And partly it's because it's considered a good luck day, particularly among Jewish people. And many Jewish people were involved in the publishing world in New York City. And so, as a matter of fact, it's considered such a good luck day. It's a day to get married. And before all of this fancy weddings on the weekends, many, many Jewish people would get married on Tuesdays because it's considered a good luck day. And when I started this radio program, my first program, which was almost going to be 3 years, it was on March 17th. It was a Tuesday, so I was feeling very good about that, and it was also St. Patrick's Day.
Sure.
So that's why, I think that's really why, the main reason why it's always Tuesdays.
Interesting.
Isn't it interesting?
I've often wondered. And, yeah. And usually the answer you get is, well, because that's the way they've always done it.
That's the way they've always, but yeah. But it was, yeah. I think, always because the original in New York City, the printers, so many of the printers were Jewish, and they said, this is a good day. Let's get it out
day. So I like it.
It's nice, huh?
Wasn't that a good interview? He tells the story of his story so entertainingly. When I leave here, I'm going to the library and get the first the last child see the beginning.
Exactly. The Last Child is quite an amazing book. It just blows you away when you read it. You think, wow. And as I said, it opens with this scene of an eagle's nest that is so dramatic, and you never forget it. That's what I love about a book, when you never forget something. And in Carol's case, you never forget her characters. You never forget Orion the cat, and you never forget Aunt Ibby. And we're going to talk more about that in a minute. We're going to do a few commercials, and then I have somebody else coming on the line in a few minutes. Okay.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow. And like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat. I would flip-flop all night long. I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry MyPillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
MyPillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Come on! Now I want you to answer me and say, yes, I'm ready.
She stood in the street, smiling from her head to her feet. I said, oh, hey, what is this? Now, baby, now, maybe she's in need of a kiss. I said, oh, hey, what's your name, baby? Maybe we can see things the same. Now, don't you wait, I hesitate. Let's move before.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and hi, I have on the phone with me Paul Abraham. Hi, are you there, Paul?
I am. How are you?
Well, I just love your accent. I just love it. It's
And you led in with Paul Rogers.
Well, I had to. I love that song.
Yeah, I worked for that guy for a while.
I know. That's why I played it. It was one of my favorites.
You're so smart.
Well, I am so thrilled to have you on today, Paul, because your book, The Gospel According to Abraham, is just a fun book because you get to talk about all, well, I mean, is that not the life to be a tour manager for rock groups? I mean, what?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, it depends on what you call a life. Sometimes I was wondering what in the hell I was doing out there. But no, all in all, it was a lot of fun, and I got to see the world and got paid for it. It's just amazing.
It is. Of course, being a tour manager is not an easy job. If anybody is out there who thinks, I mean, I have been a manager for Cub Scout groups and Boy Scout groups, but boy, oh boy, if you want excitement in your life, I think you've had it, Paul.
I did. I most certainly did, and I had to pick the ones that would give me the most challenge, which Lynyrd Skynyrd was an absolute challenge.
Wow, and yeah. You got to, well, tell us about how you started working with them and. Tell us about some of the tours that you did with them, because you had an exciting time.
I did. Started working with them in 87. Now, this was 10 years after the plane crash, and I went out on the Lynyrd Skynyrd tribute tour. Gary Rossington, who's the leader of the band, asked me to come out with him. I'd never done anything in my life like that before, but he said, oh, Paul, it's only going to be 32 shows. And I said, oh, okay, fine, I can do that. Well, 10 years later, we were still out there counting up to, I think, maybe 3,200 shows. But I worked for them on the tribute tour. And then after that, when they, I worked for them to 1997, from 87 to 97. And, oh, my goodness, we literally went all over the world. Went to Japan, Europe two or three times. Had a week vacation in Hawaii that they paid me for. Who gets to do a job like that? It was just incredible.
The logistics of moving with a group of people is always difficult, but moving with a group of wild people, must have been fun.
It was fun at times, and it was, I mean, like I said, it was extremely challenging. And it was, look, when I was born and raised, I was born in Mississippi, and the first job I ever had was thinning cotton, and I worked for 45 cents an hour. This was 10 times harder than that. I guarantee you. But I got paid a little bit more than that, thank goodness. But it was a great time. And they were good friends of mine. I first met them in 1974 when my brother and I promoted them in concert in a little town called Cleveland, Mississippi. And it was just incredible. The guys, they had never been in the Mississippi Delta before, and they were just enamored by all the people that came out to the show. They loved it. We had an old black blues guy that during the set changes, he would get out there with his guitar and a microphone and entertain the crowds, and Ronnie Van Zant was totally smitten with this guy. I would like to think he wrote Curtis Lowe because of him, but I can't say that he did. But what a great song, and what a great guy that Ronnie Van Zant was. He was just a super, super person.
Well, it was way
before his time.
Yeah, it was such a tragedy. Of course, the plane crash at the time was October 20th, 1977, and we thought we would never have the group back again, and it was great that they came back, I think, because they've kept the music alive. And as you said, you know, Ronnie Van Zant was a special musician, a really special musician. And
no doubt.
It would have been sad not to have this music go on, because I know he would love it, because the shows are so exciting. It's just so wonderful. Of all the rock groups, and I've seen a lot in my day. I saw a lot, but I think that they can't be beat, because there's a excitement in when you have, like, I don't know, sometimes you have 20,000 people, 30,000 people in the audience, and they are just all into this music.
Oh, going crazy! I mean, going absolutely. That was the most fun part of my job, was standing on side of the stage and obviously listening to the band and keeping my eye on them to make sure that they were all, you know, that they had what they needed during the show. And to be able to look out in the crowd and see these big old guys, I mean, they've got these, you know, got tattoos all up and down their arms. And when Freebird is played, they all break down in tears. And I mean, it was just incredible. It really was. It was so much fun being out there, and it was so gratifying to be able to see that part of it.
So what was it like the first time that you did you went overseas and you had to get a passport and travel? Well, wow.
Passport and visas for everybody and the whole bit. I mean, it was an undertaking, and that was my job. I mean, my job was to make sure that we had, you know, all the visas, all the transportation, the flights, the buses, the hotels, the media, the fan club, the whole bit. That was my gig. And from what I understand, I did it real well, or at least that's what I'm told. You know, I really did. I put my heart and soul in it, because my heart and soul was in the music. And Ronnie Van Zant, oh my goodness, the songs that he wrote, and I could relate to every one of them. I mean, I really could. And he just was, you know, an incredible artist. But traveling through Europe and getting to see the Eiffel Tower and going to the Louvre in Paris and then going to see the Tower of London and, you know, and then going to Berlin and walking under the Brandenburg Gate and literally walking back 50 years in time. It was just incredible. And to be able to see these things and do these things and literally actually get paid for it, how does that even happen, you know? But it happened.
And also to see the crowds in Europe, because I know I lived in England for a number of years, and when American groups would come through, oh, wow, the audiences would be so thrilled with it was amazing.
Well, we played at the Hammersmith Odeon. I'm sure you've probably heard of that
place
in London. And Oh, yeah. I mean, they packed the house. I mean, I think we did like 3 nights in a row there and sold out every night. But it was, you know, just so much fun. And today I still talk to the friends that I made out there. One in particular named Ian Monk. He works for the government in Scotland. And he writes a blog. And it's called it's the Lynyrd Skynyrd blog. And he called me one day and said, look, I'd love to do an interview with you. And I said, okay, great. So he interviewed me, and a couple of weeks later he sent it to me. And the title, Patsy, was The Gospel According to Abraham. And I said, dude, I am stealing that. You could go right ahead. You know? I mean, my goodness, I couldn't have come up with a better title. Oh. Anyway, but I really owe that to Ian Monk.
Well,
my good friend.
It's a perfect title for the book, and it's full of wonderful stories. Let's talk about a few of my favorites. Well, I played Paul Rodgers because I love him, and he's quite an amazing person, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He really is. He's Paul is pretty quiet when it comes right down to it. I mean, he's a strictly business type of person. Now, the rest of the guys in the band were just partiers, and they had a ball, and I had a ball with them, to tell you the truth. But Paul was pretty straightforward. He wanted to know everything that was going on that day, starting from, you know, early in the morning till after the show. And you know, that was the easy part of my job, because I made sure that I advanced everything properly and got everything all set up. But just a super nice guy, and we got close.
And he has a great voice, an amazing voice, and so many people have, I think, learned from him.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, Ronnie Van Zant especially. Ronnie Van Zant idolized him, and Gary Rossington idolized you know, the band and all the musicians in the band, and it was you know, just real special working for Paul. It just came out of the blue. They had come out and opened for Skynyrd on several shows, and then I was at home, we were off, and I get a call from Paul Rodgers' manager and asked me if I would like to go out and do some dates with him. I said, absolutely. So I jumped at that opportunity and worked with him. It wasn't a long tour, but it was enough for us to get real close and enjoy each other's company, and like I said, the band members, I sure enjoyed their company. We had a good time. Had a great time.
And another person that you've worked with who I also admire so much is Michael Peterson. His song,
Bless Your Heart.
From Here to Eternity. Yeah, From Here to Eternity. Isn't that a wonderful song?
Yes, it is. It hit number one, and it's probably the number one most requested song
for weddings.
For weddings, yeah, absolutely. And Michael's such a genuinely good person. I mean, he is just the salt of the earth. He really is. And I talked to him not too long ago. He just released a new album, and it has some old standards on it, some old country standards, like Friends in Low Places and Wichita Lineman and stuff like that he covers, and it's just incredible.
Oh, he really is so talented, and it is always such a pleasure. I'm happy to hear he's got a new album coming up, because I will love that, because I think his voice, his, especially when he sings that song, it's just get tears in your eyes with that song.
Oh yeah, I mean, he talk about heart and soul. You know, he puts everything he has into his music every night on that stage. And he's just a, you know, super songwriter. Excellent. And a super artist.
And so when you had all of these guys, all these, you know, guys that you're working with, how'd you end up working with Miley Cyrus?
Well, actually, I went to work for her dad. I had quit the road. I had left Michael Peterson. I worked with him for a year. I wish I could have stayed longer, but he didn't tour anymore for a while after that. So, obviously, I needed work. And I was planning on not going back out on the road. And Ed King, who was the guitar player in Skynyrd and also one of the co-writers for Sweet Home Alabama, he called me up one day and he said, you know, Billy Ray Cyrus is looking for a tour manager. Would you be interested in going out? I said, I don't know. I've heard really good things about him. I heard he's real easy to work with, but I just don't know if I want to do that anymore. And he said, well, at least go talk to him. So I did. I went out to Billy's farm out south of Nashville. Gorgeous, beautiful place. It's called the Singing Hills Farm. Just incredible. And I talked to him about an hour. And he asked me if I'd go to work for him, and I said, absolutely, and I did. I worked for him on and off for about 12 years. Well, the first time I saw Miley, we were in at Dollywood, and she comes out. She's cute, just a cute little thing. She's probably 5 years old. And I said, honey, are you hungry? And she said, well, yeah, I am. I said, well, catering is still up in the back. And she said, oh, no, I can't eat anything. My mom says that I can't eat anything. And I'm like, it just stopped me in my tracks. Well, Miley, her whole career was guided by her mother. And, I mean, literally, when they were living in Tennessee, all Tish could talk about was living in California. And they wanted to live in California. Well, history, you know, Miley went out and... she auditioned for one of the support roles in Hannah Montana and got the lead role. And then Billy Ray came along with her. And in short, the only time I really worked for Miley, sometime I would accompany her to like things like the Vanderbilt Children's Hospital and, you know, anytime she might have been doing a personal appearance or something like that. And I was home, and she was in Tennessee or something like that, and we would go out, and I would go out and help her do that sort of stuff. But well, I worked for her dad.
Well,
I was
Paul,
her dad's guy.
You know, Paul, I think your book is fascinating, and for anyone who loves music and loves to know the story behind the story, they will enjoy this great book that you've written, and. You know, The Gospel According to Abraham is a wonderful title, and it's available, you know, on Amazon and where books are sold. And I hope that everyone will go out and get it. And, Paul, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Patsy, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Okay. Well, you take care and keep rocking, okay?
I'll keep rocking, and you do the same.
Okay. Bye-bye now,
bye-bye.
Paul.
Bye.
Oh, isn't he nice? He's so sweet.
Another nice man.
He is.
You get to talk to some really delightful people.
I do. Isn't it nice? Somebody once, well, I get this from listeners every once in a while. I'll get an email. Well, why do you always say you like that book? Like, okay.
Probably because she liked it.
It's my program. If you're not on my program, I probably don't like your book. Listen, no, and it's true. A very famous author's publicist sent me the latest book, and I read it, and I said, no. And the publicist said, what? And I said, no. And the publicist said, what? I said, I don't like it. I don't like it. There's something off. I'm not going to do it. And the publicist was, what? I said, look, I do a lot of your people, and if I like the book, I'll review it.
Sure.
But I'm not going to have, what can I say to somebody if I really don't like the book and they come on and what can I say? I can't say, I really don't like your book. I can't say, you're no Carol J. Perry when it comes to writing. You know, I want Carol J. Perry here. By the way, where are you going to be? You have some exciting things happening in your life.
I do. This, actually, day after tomorrow, Dan and I are driving over to Boca for Sleuth Fest.
Oh, again.
And last year I had the pleasure of moderating or being part of a panel. And this time I'm moderating a panel. And also I'm doing an hour presentation on writing the killer query.
Oh, and that's important.
It is important. And the rules have changed so much from God. The old days. Oh. I mean, now... you only get one chance to make your first impression, and the query letter is it. And if you fail on that...
Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. When you come back, and sometime toward the end of March, you're going to come back here and talk about the killer query letter.
Yeah.
Because it does. It kills an awful lot of people.
Yeah, and people don't like to squish their word babies down
that
much. Yeah,
I know, it's very
but
hard.
But it can be done. It can be learned, and it's so important.
Now, I have one author, and I will talk about that when you come back, who actually wrote a one-sentence query letter, and she got a book deal. Now, I happen to know what it is, and I want people to try to guess what this is. I can't. She won't let me tell. But it's not. She didn't write, "I'm a millionaire, publish my book." No. It was a very unexpected. It's really, literally, it's one nice long sentence, but it's a sentence, one sentence. Mm-hmm. And she got a book deal based on that one sentence. It's.
Awesome.
Yeah, isn't with that?
And it whispered in my ear.
It was really big. It was, and it turned out to be a big hit too. I mean, amazing, absolutely amazing. Someday she probably will, but right now she wants to keep it secret. So, but it's fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we have a lot of things that you're going to talk about when you come back. You'll talk about query letters. Mm-hmm. You'll give us a report about Sleuth Fest.
Yes.
And whatever else is coming up. We have some exciting things happening. And, of course, you're working on another book?
I'm working on book 8 in the series.
And when's the deadline for this one?
June. I think it's June.
So you have time.
One hopes. I'm always chasing a deadline. But it's good stress, Patsy. And if I didn't have deadline, I would fool around for
years. Exactly. Well, the new book is called It Takes a Coven. It's... at Barnes & Noble on the end. That's so exciting for an author to be able to walk into a real bookstore and see her books are really right up there.
I've asked all of my family, of course, and some of my readers, go take a selfie in front of it in your local Barnes & Noble. Send it to me. Because Orion, my cat, does the newsletter now because I don't like to do it, so the cat does it.
Oh, good. He needed some work.
He did. When he's not busy
too
solving
fat and
mysteries.
Lazy. Yeah.
He is fat. But I love it. So I think that some of them will send me selfies and probably Orion will put them in the newsletter.
Okay, perhaps you'd share with me.
I will.
And we can put it on my new fancy webpage.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be nice? In my new fancy webpage, you can see at radio-joyonpaper.com. Go there and I will have all of these interviews today up and other fantastic interviews and news about writers and things that are happening. And remember, my word for the year is Facebook. Please go to my Facebook page, Radio Joy on Paper, and like me, and I will like you and the whole process. But I have discovered, people, that my guest last week, he sold 3,200 books just from his Facebook advertising. So it's really an interesting way for authors to get their name out there. And I found him on that Facebook page. So you never know. If you're an author, be on Facebook. Like me, and I might like you. And then I might even invite you here. But meanwhile, make sure that you write. Keep writing. If you haven't started, start. Right, Carol? Isn't that the only
way? Absolutely.
The only way to get a book published is to write.
Yeah. And if you only write one page a day, by the end of the year, you'll have over 300 words.
And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today. I'm going to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him because I love to be saluted. And that's it for the day. It's been an exciting day. Bye-bye now.